The story as told about LA in the late 40s, early 50s, how the police and interacted with Hollywood. You know, the picture is painted in movies like LA Confidential, where the police took care of stars and starlets who had problems, and evidence might get buried and cases resolved or sealed or buried altogether. That is the scenario that Steve Hodell encountered as he started digging into the story of the Black Dahlia and his own father. And you know, the DA has a this box that no one had seen for 50 years. Steve Hodell is allowed to see it, and as we're about to hear, the things that are in that box tend to confirm his growing suspicions. On the other hand, the LAPD, which should have massive files, it's another story about what evidence still existed there, and we're going to get into that in our next segment here on Coast to Coast AM. So, Steve, you go into this file. You're allowed to see the stuff in the box. What did you find? Did you find anything that was contrary to what you suspected?
Well, actually, one of the things I might add that Steve Lopez, also in his reporting on the newspaper things, discovers that George Hodell was suspected of murdering his secretary 2 years earlier. And he writes that in his column, too, talking to his sources that he was actually suspected for murdering his personal secretary at the
Is this the
clinic.
lady that OD'd?
Yeah, supposedly it was listed as a suicide, but they believed it was a overdose, a forced overdose by him. So anyway, I'm going through the transcripts and I start reading them, and I've got the transcripts in front of me. I'll read you some of the excerpts verbatim. Supposing I did kill the Black Dahlia, they couldn't prove it now. They can't talk to my secretary anymore because she's dead. And that refers to the secretary that he killed 18 months earlier, who probably could have connected him. The other thing we discover is that in the police reports is that he was dating Elizabeth Short. So they confirm that he was a former suitor of hers and was dating her. Those are actually in the police reports. And he goes on to say, put a pillow over her head. Now, this is about his secretary. Covered her with a blanket, got a taxi, called Georgia Street Receiving. Expired at 12:39. They thought there was something fishy. Anyhow, they may have figured it out. Maybe I did kill my secretary. Then he's another day, he says, I'm in trouble. Black Dahlia passports. Police have pictures of me and that girl. I thought I destroyed them. He talks about performing abortions at his clinic. And then he says, this is the best payoff I've seen between law enforcement agencies. You don't have the right connections made at the DA's office. Don't confess ever. We're just a couple of smart boys. He's talking to a German baron, Haringa, who's there with him on these conversations. Now, he suspects the phones are tapped, but he doesn't have a clue that the house is wired for sound. But then the big kicker, this is the one that really turned the whole thing around and gave me an explanation. Is about 3 days into the surveillance. Now these guys are, what they did was they picked up George Hodell and took him into the Hall of Justice. And while they got him in there, they go out to our house, and they break in, and they actually wire it for sound. They put microphones in the living room and in the bedroom, and run hard line through the basement. They run a hard line to Hollywood Station, about 2.5 miles away, where I would work for 17 years, and sit in the basement. And they've got teams of two-man teams 24/7 for 6 weeks. And they're listening to these conversations live. And anyway, I get to page three, and this is what really blows me away. I start reading the transcript. And it's February 18th, 1950, 7:35 p.m., Hodell Franklin House bugging tape, spool one. 4:20, woman asking for the operator several times, sounded as though she was crying. 4:25 p.m., woman asking for operator again, said something not heard to operator. 8:20, sounded as though the two men, this is Haringa, the baron and dad, went down steps and entered the basement and began digging. Something was referred to, not a trace. It also appeared as a pipe was being hit. A woman screams. More blows. A woman screams again. I'm reading this, and I can't believe what I'm reading. It's like, my God, they're 5 minutes away, sitting there, and they do nothing. you know, why aren't they out the door, over to the house, and do a rescue? But they do nothing. So at the very least, this is a serious felony assault. More likely, I'm absolutely convinced it was a murder on tape. So, and they go on for another four weeks. So basically, this is, to me, is the explanation of why the cover-up. And you got to understand the timing of it all. Chief Parker is about to take literally weeks away from becoming the new chief. And there's been all of this pressure to solve all of these unsolved crimes. And he knows that if this comes out, he won't be able to take power. And he wants to clean up Dodge, you know. And so I think there was a, you know, the candles were burning late night at City Hall. And they sat down and they said, look, if this comes out, we won't be able to take power and do the things we want to do. Let's lock this away. Let's put this in the vault for now, and we'll come back to it at a future time. But, you know, otherwise, you know, we're not going to have a chance. So it was kind of a Machiavellian decision on their part.
You do think that some of the evidence has been purged, that there's a reference to photographs of a Mr. Barnes, a Lieutenant Barnes, that you think was your dad, in the company of Elizabeth Short. They checked into a motel or something, and there's a photograph, at least one, right?
We discovered, after the book comes out and all of this information, we do, Dateline does an hour on my investigation, and Court TV does an hour, and 48 Hours does an hour, and they interview LAPD, and they have nothing. Everything has disappeared. What we know from the transcripts is that they were all turned over to LAPD, to Thad Brown, Chief of Detectives, personally handed to him, and the DA's guys were removed from the case and ordered not to pursue anything. So we know that they were turned over to Thad Brown, but today's LAPD knows nothing about it. They didn't know they existed. And so everything was removed. All of the physical evidence for DNA and stuff is missing. They don't know where it is. So basically, it was, you know, a cover-up back then, supposedly for the good of the city and the good of the department and the good of themselves. And we would have never had Lopez not, you know, gotten this file, we would have never known any of this. LAPD that would have never known any of this. Today's LAPD. So, you know, that's where these guys, these old detectives, Thad Brown and Parker, they have, you know, blood on their hands, in the sense that, you know, had they done what there's, and then of course the other thing was that Dad split. He leaves the country right then, makes it easy for him. And I'm sure they rationalized, look, he's out of the country, maybe we can find him, maybe we can't. Maybe we can extradite him, maybe we can't. If he comes back, he'll get Geisler again and kick our butts. You know, look, let's just come back this future time. Let's clean up, get rid of the corruption and stuff. And I think that's exactly what happened. And the sad thing is, because they allowed him to remain free and they never came back to it, he would go on to kill more and more. He did additional killings in a different, you know, in Manila and other places.
You know, I think about the police, what it must have been like for them at that time, the tips coming in and calls, and it continued. You even mentioned it in the book. It continued, probably it continues to this day. People are calling in, I've figured it out, I know who killed the Black Dahlia, and they go, yeah, we've heard it 1,000 times. You know, I, after a while, I can see it gets old.
Yeah, but, you know, there's so much more to, I mean, I've actually been able to, and that's what these other, you know, there's a book two and a book three, and what they are, it's really all one investigation. It's like an ongoing investigation. And I've been able to actually establish physical evidence connected from the Franklin house to the crime scene. You know, the cement bags we talked about and the manure bag, those were actually, I discovered that Lloyd Wright had a file at UCLA Special Collections. I went and looked at it, and I'll be damned if there wasn't a file on George Odell in the Wright collection, and there are receipts for these 50-pound bags of cement. He hired Wright to do some repairs. And the date is January the 9th and the 10th of 1947. So four days before the murder, these bags are at the Hodel residence, empty, you know, empty cement 50-pound bags. And this is what he used to transport the body parts after he after she was tortured and washed clean in the bathtub. He used these to upper and the lower torso, transported these bags to the crime scene, took her off the bags and left the bags near the body. Yeah, we don't have serial numbers on the bags, but you know, how many suspects are walking around with 50-pound cement bags, paper bags in there? You know, and he used it to protect the car and stuff. So, I mean, so you've got the physical evidence there. You've got admissions. The other kicker is that we've got actual, from the, all of the top cops that were involved in the investigation, we've got them admitting that George Hodel did it. I'll read you their statements. So we've got from Chief Parker, quote, "We identified the Black Dahlia suspect. He was a doctor," end quote. Well, we know from the DA files that that doctor was George Hodel. Thad Brown, quote, "The Black Dahlia case was solved. He was a doctor who lived on Franklin Avenue in Hollywood," end quote. Quote, from Lieutenant Jemison, DA, "We know who the Black Dahlia killer was. He was a doctor, but we didn't have enough to put him away." Well, yeah, they did. And then finally, we've got the undersheriff. "The Black Dahlia case was solved. It'll never come out. The suspect was a doctor they all knew in Hollywood involved in abortions." Again, from the DA files, we know who this doctor was. It was George Hodel.
You think he had an accomplice, at least for some of the crimes, right? The guy who was in the room when your sister was molested.
Yes, Fred Sexton definitely was an accomplice. And in fact, I've just come out with a new book a few weeks ago, which is a standalone double homicide from 1938 called In the Mesquite, where the two of them murdered a woman in Texas, West Texas, when he was doctoring in New Mexico and Arizona. He was about 300 miles away. Anyway, they committed this. I've put a very solid case together on that. That's a 70-year-old whodunit, and it's just amazing. And I make a very strong, compelling case that it was Sexton and George that did that murder, and Sexton's involved in other murders too.
You mentioned very briefly earlier in our conversation about this famed photographer, Man Ray, who was, as you describe him, sort of a sadomasochist who was into the same kind of stuff your dad was in. And you found some photos that he had produced, one of which seems to have been the inspiration for how the body was displayed in the vacant lot.
Yeah, this is This is a serious and important crime signature to the whole thing, and it explains my father's psychopathy, really. And it was all about murders of fine art. The posing of the body in that position he was copying his close friend Man Ray's photograph called The Minotaur, which is a woman bisected at the waist, hands over her head in that same position. Dad also did some cuttings on the body to another painting of Man Ray's, an earlier painting, which is called Les Equivoques. It's a very unusual geometrical shape that he's carved onto Elizabeth Short's right hip. And then there's the cutting of the mouth, the lips almost ear to ear. Another painting called The Lovers, which is a couple of lips from horizon to horizon that Man Ray did. And this gets very involved, and I go into details. There's actually three or four different surrealists who knew of the crime. I'm not saying they were involved in it, but they actually, after the fact, and they did paintings that revealed their knowledge of it. Even Sexton, who was an artist of some repute in his day here locally, it's what I call a confession, a confession on canvas. It's just amazing. In this painting that Sexton did, he's got bisected breast away from the body. He's got the woman placed in a minotaur position. I mean, it's an amazing thing. I'm working with some top people in Hollywood now, and we're looking at a miniseries to try and present it next year. There's just so much here. It'll, you know, 6 or 8 episodes, because there's just so much to cover. You know, we've been talking for almost, 2.5 hours, and you know, we have scratched the surface. Probably one of the biggest and the most dramatic evidence. Like I say, it keeps unfolding. And a lot of this goes to credit to people who are listening in on my talks and reading. I have a blog site, and I try and keep it up to date. Anyway, I got an email last year, November, or September, or I guess it was July of 2018, from a woman in Indianapolis, Indiana. She says, "Hey, I found this letter in my grandfather's personal effects, and he worked for LAPD as an informant in the 40s, and he lays out naming your father as the killer of the Black Dahlia, and another victim, Louise Springer, which is one of my lone woman murders, which I absolutely sure that George did." So she says, "Would you be interested in seeing it?" I said, "Yeah." So she sends me the original letter.
Oh, man.
And it just blew me away. And this is in BDA 3. I go into detail on this. And it's a 3-page letter in case of, and it was never to be revealed. It was, the envelope reads, "In case of the death of either of my two daughters." And he turns out he knew George. They were friends, acquaintances. And he was working for LAPD, paid informant for LAPD during the 1940s. And he lays out, he says he killed the Black Dahlia and he killed Louise Springer. And we both knew Louise Springer personally. And it's been covered up. I mean, he just goes on in this 3-page letter naming George and basically saying the police covered it up and allowed George to remain free. And it's just like, you can't make this stuff up. I mean, I couldn't believe that, you know, 70 years later, an original letter comes in. Anyway, I wrote it all up. It's in detail and stuff, but he goes into extensive detail of how that went down and how they covered it up.
Is your sister still alive? Is she doing okay? No, and I ask in this context that she had, you know, there are other, we haven't even touched on this, but she was a bit of a wild child, but no daughter deserves that from her father. She ends up becoming a beatnik and poet and are hanging with those kind of people and hippies, mamas and the papas. Michelle Phillips becomes a real close friend of hers.
Right. Michelle Phillips was godmother to her children. And Tamar was a, you know, she was damaged, you know, she was sexualized at, you know, dad started her out at age 11 with oral sex. And then at 14, he actually had intercourse with her. And, you know, she was sexualized, flipped out, and, you know, did get into sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and San Francisco scene, the Hungry Eye, and became very close with Michelle Phillips. And to this day, Tamar died a few years ago. And, but, you know, tragic life, but an amazing life. I mean, she, you know, knew everybody and was associated with all kinds of interesting people. But, you know, and this was a two-edged sword for her when I, you know, wrote the book.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody knew. She didn't know I was writing, investigating the Black Dahlia case. She just knew I was writing a book about LAPD, but had no clue.
So makes you wonder if she would have told you about all that about your father if she had known what you're going to do with it.
The conversations we had were extensive and you know, after I got into it. And she talks, and one of the things she told me was, she, you know, just comes out of nowhere, was she says, "Well, you know, George was suspected of killing a secretary." And we did, at that time, we didn't know the name of the secretary, she didn't. And she said, and he called Dorothy, mother, down to take, you know, she was writing and disclosing some information about him, and she was unconscious but alive. And your mom went down and got these papers that she'd written, and George told her to burn them, and she took them and burned them.
Makes your mom an accomplice.
It does make her, and that, wow. Now he's got her by the short hairs, you know, because, and I'm sure he used that. If anything comes, you know, if I'm going to jail, you're going to jail.
Steve Hodell is my guest, talking about the Black Dahlia case, murder. We'll go open up the phone lines here in just a moment. Billy Squire takes us into the break. Dr. George Hodell seemingly had it all. He was brilliant, wealthy, prominent, lived in a posh home, had celebrity friends, But clearly, the wires were not connected. Something was wrong. Something was off. And from all the available evidence, he was a bit of a deviant, a sadomasochist who not only may have committed the Black Dahlia murder, but possibly many other savage murders as well. In a moment, in our final segment with Steve Hodell, we open up the phone lines with your calls and questions. Maybe some of you have some theories as well. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. Our final segment with Steve Hodell talking about the Black Dahlia murder. Before I open up the phone line, Steve, what's missing? What other pieces do you need? And, you know, and what would be the point of getting more if there's nobody to prosecute?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you've got a hell of a lot of victims out there. And, you know, you'll hear a lot of detectives say, you know, that closure is bullshit. It's not. It's, you know, knowing who done it is offer some degree of closure to the victims. So to me, that's critical. I've got my dad's full DNA profile. I've been trying to get LAPD to, you know, do some work on that. There's plenty of sources for potential DNA.
Oh.
Their problem is, see, they don't want to open this bag up. They don't even want to look at it. And they can't defeat the evidence. So all they can say is, we don't have time. We're too busy with other stuff. And the problem is they don't want to, they think it's throwing mud on their two greatest heroes, Parker and Thad Brown. And it's not. It's getting to the truth of the matter. And so it's very frustrating for me. I mean, the DNA would do it. But truthfully, we've got everything. We've got physical evidence connecting from the residence to the crime scene. We've got handwriting that to this day, none of their experts have been able to say, no, it's not George Hodell. We've got the confessions. We've got, you know, tape-recorded confessions. We've got everything we need. It's just a matter of LAPD not wanting to admit to it. But the big thing is the murder on tape. They can't come out and say, yeah, Hodell's right, and if he's right, then that means that murder occurred and we did nothing. And so that's where they have blood on their hands, because he continued to kill after that. So that's what's frustrating. And but, you know, the truth has been presented. I mean, it's, you know, it's way beyond reasonable doubt now. It was strong on the first book, but we've advanced that so much now that it's no longer even in doubt. You know, the one thing I did want to mention was I spent a whole chapter on rehabilitating Elizabeth Short's reputation. Hack writers really trashed her big time. They turned her into a druggie, an alcoholic.
Prostitute.
Prostitute. And that really got my blood up. And none of that was true. She was a rather naive, young, you know, 22 going on 15, looking to fall in love with Lieutenant Wright. That was all that she was about. Quite sweet, actually, but extremely naive, and, you know, came out here and got in shark-infested waters. So, you know, and the other problem is, of course, you know, the thing that people need to know is it's not just Steve Hodell saying that these other murders are connected. It was LAPD saying that, the DA's office. They were actively investigating 5 or 6 of these murders themselves in the files. So it's not just me speculating. They confirmed that they believed he was at least connected to at least 4 or 5.
We'll take a couple of calls. We're going to start with Jan in Brooklyn on the wild card line. Hey, Jan, good morning. You're on with Steve Hodell.
Hi. I think a lot of people do these horrible, terrible things because they have entities. And I was wondering, like, around the house, what was he like? Did he scream? Did he carry on? What kind of person was he?
Yeah, well, I mean, ultimately in my investigation, I do see him as a Jekyll and Hyde. But of course, at that time, as a boy growing up, he was just a cool, suave, sophisticated, neat dad. I mean, you know, he wasn't warm and fuzzy, but at the same time, we never suffered any physical abuse. My brothers and I didn't. I mean, we were taken down to the basement and spanked with a razor strap. But that's kind of like old school. That's what you did back then in the 40s. You know, if you did something wrong, you got spanked by your dad. So we never considered that. And, you know, and in and out of when I would see him through the years, through the decades, I remained close to him. I loved my father.
Did you say, I'm trying to remember if it's your older brother or Duncan who had some kind of knowledge, you talked to him for the book and had some kind of knowledge of some skullduggery on the part of your dad?
Well, Duncan, of course, was, you know, so he was 28, 30, 14 years older. So he was a teenager, 17. He was coming to the Franklin house. Dad was fixing him up with girls, prostitutes, probably women, and his buddies. So he was involved in having a great time as a teenager. He was actually in the Merchant Marines. And he told me of an incident where he remembers Dad took out a lipstick and wrote it on the breasts of one of the partygoers, a woman. She had topless, and he was writing designs on her breasts, and everybody thought that was funny. So that didn't have much meaning to me other than, of course, then when the Jean French lipstick on the breasts, that had meaning. But he was upset with Tamar because, you know, after that all broke, it ruined his teen sex life, I guess.
We're going to go to Mike in Colorado. Hey, Mike, good morning. You're on with Steve Hodell.
Good evening, gentlemen. First of all, I wanted to thank you both for your courageous work that you do.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
What's on your mind?
What's that?
What's on your mind?
Oh, my question for you, Steve, is what do you think in cases like the Black Dahlia, the Zodiac Killer, Jeffrey Dahmer, Scott Peterson, what do you think makes these cases stand the test of time and acquire so much interest after all this time has passed? And thank you for taking my call, George.
Thanks.
Yeah, I think it's just the, I guess people like a horror show. I don't know. True crime is probably one of the most popular forms of entertainment, and everybody wants to be a detective, and many civilians are great detectives. I can't tell you how many really good clues I've been given and approved valuable from readers and regular, you know, the plumber and the truck driver and the, you know, so I think it's just the excitement of trying to figure out who done it.
West of the Rockies, Jeff in Sonora. Hi, Jeff.
Good evening, gentlemen. I've been following this case quite intensely over the years, and it's an honor to listen to him dispel all this current information. I was thinking along the same lines as far as trying to get DNA, but I know that the LA County oftentimes blocks them. They also are blocking the information that would probably help narrow out the Zodiac Killer. But I was wondering, why do you think that they covered for your dad so much? Was it just because maybe the partner was doing the murders along with them, or was it something deeper, do you think? They listened as a woman got murdered and they didn't intervene.
I think the answer is that, you know, he was what they used to call in those days a high jingo. He was untouchable. He had all of the, I mean, this is part of it. He had all of the files on who was doing what to whom, you know, and that included police officials, that included movie people, that included politicos. So, you know, and if he was taken down, you know, he's not going to go quietly. He's going to lay all that out. So not only did he have that sensitive, you know, medical information, sex stuff, but basically he knew, he grew up in LA and he knew a hell of a lot more and a lot of different things. So I think it was a combination of he's gone, he's out of the country, thank God, you know, let's just let sleeping dogs lie. I think that was basically it, the combination of the two.
Thanks, Jeff. You know, there are, as we mentioned a couple of times during our conversation, other theories and that people have invested their time and effort into proving. Red Manley is one of the names that's popped up over and over, and I guess for good reason. I mean, he was in proximity to the victim on the day that she was killed, right? Or at least right around that
time.
Yeah,
and there's the whole San Diego incident where he went and picked her up in San Diego and he brought her back and dropped her at the Biltmore, got her property and stuff. But he was in San Francisco at the time of the murder.
And you went to the FBI. You FOIA'd the records on this. What did they have? How much did they have?
Well, there's a whole investigation. They have a lot on it, and of course, they were pushing for local medical schools. They were doing handwriting comparisons, and on a lot of the medical students in the nearby, I think it was USC Medical or wherever it was they were, and they had done a lot of comparisons because they were convinced it was a surgeon or somebody trained in surgery. So they did that, and there wasn't really a hell of a lot in there. I did get the files, but there nothing that really jumped out as being, they did try and get some fingerprints, but nothing really super. They pretty much kind of left it mostly to LA law enforcement and the DA's office.
There was some kind of reference to, maybe it was a statement from a witness saying that Elizabeth Short had told people that she was seeing a man who was going to marry her. Somebody was in the military that you think was your dad pretending to be a military guy?
I think, she had a lot of contacts with, she had, one of the things they recovered was, or actually they didn't recover it. It was sent in by George Odell, was an address book, but a lot of the pages were cut out of the address book. He mailed in a lot of her personal effects to the press and the police, and photographs of her that he'd taken from her photo album. And there were 75 names of men in there, so they investigated all of those names. But he had cut out, 8-10 pages or more. And so again, this whole taunting and teasing thing was a critical part of him, and it plays through in many of his other crimes.
And the photos that were in the photo album that first set you down this road, you're pretty sure that they were taken, at least one of them was taken inside your house.
Yeah, well, and that's probably one of the biggest controversies is that photo her or not? That's where a lot of people said, oh, the photo isn't her, absolutely not. And if that doesn't hold, then the whole thing falls apart, which of course is BS because, we've now got the police report saying that George Odell did in fact know and date her and was a suitor, and that's, so you can throw the photo out if you want. But I had a company in Germany, high-tech facial recognition experts, do a comparison on that photo to Elizabeth, and they came back with a 95% hit, saying, it's highly probable that it could be her, but we need a 99.9 to call it a positive. But they were impressed on how high a match it was, and for other reasons I lay out, I do believe it is her, but again, even if it isn't her, it doesn't matter. That's what one of the things that got me started is all.
Going to Deborah in New Jersey. Deborah, good morning. Hello.
I have some questions. I did read, I don't know if it was in your book, there was a secret room in your house, the one you grew up in, like a secret door somewhere that went into a room that was just for your father. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's gotten distorted. Actually, what it was it was a sliding bookcase. It was a room, but it was only like 4 by 12 feet. It was actually built in at the original 1926 for hiding booze.
I see. Okay. And
but it wasn't a room.
A lot of this stuff took place. Was your mother working, or where was she when a lot of these things could have taken place? Where was she?
Well, that was my concern, and I never figured it. I figured it was somewhere else, not our home, because I figured how he couldn't do this with us living there. Well, come to find out in the DA reports, when my mother's interviewed on it, it turns out we were gone for a month, or almost a month, away from the house during that time period. So Dad had the house all to himself.
Was John Houston involved in any of this, you think?
Well, as a friend, I think it was all, there were a whole bunch of people that knew after the fact. I don't think he was involved in the actual crime itself, no. Others, I think Sexton could have been, but we'll probably never know. But not most of these others were aware of it. There was an inner circle.
Maybe participated in other different things.
I don't think Houston did, no. I think he had his own problems, but I don't think they were murder.
Thank you for the call, Deborah. You know, as you're heading down this rabbit hole, there had to come some particular point. I don't know how far you were into it when it suddenly dawns on you. My father is a killer, a vicious killer, and maybe a mass killer. And that's got to be a lot of weight on you.
Yeah, I've been through kind of every emotion possible. I mean, you know, one of the things I recognized early on was, you know, the trained homicide detective does his thing, and the loving son does his thing. But you can't. I don't want to contaminate them, so I had to keep them separate. And that, but you know, right now, and I've been through every kind of emotion you can think of in regards to my father, especially from considering that I loved him so much. And I still love him. A part of me still loves him. He created me. His blood is flowing through me. How can you unlove a father? But at the same time, I hate the monster, the, you know, Mr. Hyde within him, who was absolutely, I mean, if I'm correct, and I believe I am, he was one of the worst sadist serial killers that's ever walked the earth. You know, I mean, he was just, and this, you know, he was an urban terrorist. This wasn't, you know, he was getting off on holding a city hostage. He did it here. He did it in Chicago. He did it in the Bay Area. He did it in Manila. And, you know, this was his, you know, this was all. And I look at I try and examine a whole bunch of this, you know, triggers that set him off. And there's a whole complex of things, starting with the rejection by the professor's wife moving forward, and his mother was, I think he was probably the victim of incest himself with his mother. There's a whole very complex psychology to all of it that's very sad, you know. And right now I just a tremendous sadness in regards to my father.
And you feel at some point, I think you wrote it in this book, is that he felt justified in killing Elizabeth Short because somehow she had wronged him.
She rejected him, and you don't reject George Hodel. And he said it in his notes, you know, the killing was justified. It was divine retribution. So, yeah, and many of his other messages on killing women are the same, that, you know, he talks about being rejected in school and stuff. So, you know, yeah.
Well, Steve, that's a heck of a job you've done on this, and I wish I had known that there are additional books. I read these 500 pages, thought, wow, this guy really did his homework, having no idea that there's more. How many more?
Yeah, actually, there's Black Dahlia. That's the one you read is Black Dahlia 1, and there's BDA 2, DDA 3, Most Evil, Most Evil 2, and then the one I've just published is the one in Texas on the double homicide, which is in the Mesquite.
All right. Well, I guess my reading for the next year is kind of booked up already here. So.
Yeah. It's all one kind of ongoing investigation, but it's amazing how much has come together. And, you know, hopefully we'll be able to present it in a visual form, too, that connects it all.
Well, we'll keep an eye out for it. And thanks very much. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again, Steve Hodel. We've got links to his book and to his website as well. And thanks to my earlier guest, Dr. Dennis McKenna, and to my colleagues there at Coast, Michael Cosio, Donna Walker, our webmaster Greg Bishop, Dan Galanti, and Chris Boros. I'll be back next Saturday night, a rare Saturday night appearance. Hope you can tune in then. Good night.